good horse, I call you my shiny black bears. To the playhouse of fortune, to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else. And as we go riding.
You're listening to episode 607 of Unwelcome Guests, Flight from Meaning, Part 2. I'm Robin Upton. And as that title suggests, this is a successor programme to last week's show. It's quite an effort to get this material into 2-hour shape, because I'm trying to get a point across which is bigger than can be comfortably explained in a couple of hours. So if you bear with me, last week we were challenging the idea that humans are somehow superior. This week we start with a very vehement Alfie Cohn challenging the idea that competition is somehow innate, and perhaps even that there is somehow an innate way that people like to be. He's emphasizing the flexibility and pointing out that actually he can find no empirical case for competition, that the main argument why competition is a good thing relies on magical thinking. Of course it's a good thing, we know it's a good thing, everybody needs a certain amount of competition. Well, in our second hour, we're going to be continuing with the David Graeber reading, a fascinating section on the arrival of coinage and how this is maybe linked to the arrival of a new sort of thinking and the way that people tended to formulate their decisions in terms of profit and loss. What do they get out of something and what does it cost them? Something that seems self-evident for a lot of people a lot of the time nowadays, but of course, before money arrived, before there was an equivalence between things of any kind, can hardly have been said to have been self-evident. And now let's get going with the Alfie Cohn, which is followed by an unedited Q&A section. He's speaking, I think this is from 2004, at a conference called Beyond Conflict.
The title of this conference gave me pause, frankly, because the way I use the word conflict, I don't see much need to move beyond it. But words pertaining to competition, aggression, conflict, cooperation, and so on, are very difficult to get straight, and sometimes we argue when we don't mean to argue about the substance. For example, when students in class help each other in a cooperative fashion, we don't call it cooperation in this country, we call it cheating. Similarly, when the word cooperation is used, again, in the classroom setting, it is used to mean obedience, as in, I want you all to cooperate now, which means do exactly what I tell you. Words are used in ways that don't always lend themselves to clarity, and that's true with conflict, too. As far as I'm concerned, and what I want to try to do in these brief introductory remarks before going on to discuss competition and then more broadly human nature, a phrase, by the way, that I think should always appear in quotation marks, I want to just say a word about conflict. I don't think there's a problem with conflict. I don't seek to move beyond it. The question is not will there be conflict or should there be, the answer to both questions being yes, as far as I'm concerned, but rather, will that conflict take place in a context that is cooperative or competitive? Now, I don't think here I fundamentally disagree with Ted Rockwell. He just uses conflict to mean something else and might substitute for it, say, controversy or dissent or something of that sort. There is a big difference between these two kinds of conflict, though, as I'm using the term. In business meetings and in dinner parties, there are people who raise objections, make arguments, disagree, in order so that everyone can be exposed to another idea, which is seen to be important, so that people can reach some agreement that's more informed or can educate. And then there are people who raise disagreements, open up controversy, to hear themselves talk, or to show how clever they are and to score points. You can smell the difference between these two kinds of conflict. You know what I'm talking about. Cooperative conflict seems to make a lot of sense. That's when people disagree with each other for a purpose that is productive or that educates. and the long literature of study showing that this tends to work better than either debate or competition on the one hand, or people all pretending some sort of magical harmony and forced consensus exists on the other. That is a literature that has been contributed to in large part by David Johnson, one of the speakers tomorrow, and he will tell you most likely about some of the studies to that effect. In fact, you might even say, to build on the last speaker's remarks, that this is parallel to what Darwin meant by natural selection. The phrase survival of the fittest, as you may know, was not coined by Darwin at all, but by Herbert Spencer, who corrupted his thinking. And in fact, the idea of survival of the fittest is one that does not involve competition by its nature at all. It merely suggests that creatures that adapt best to a changing environment are around to live and reproduce another day. It does not specify what mechanism is used in order to adapt. And thus, all of the evidence we just had presented to us suggests that cooperation is the best way for this amazing concept of evolution to take place. Similarly with conflict, it doesn't specify the mechanism of cooperation or competition. However, that doesn't mean that I agree with everything that's always said about the nature of conflict being desirable. Sam Keen and I, for example, I think we'll have to agree to disagree about some points. For example, I would never use the words atheism and barbarism in the same sentence. For another point, I think the idea that things come to us of themselves, so to speak, when we acknowledge our dark side, is a troubling point for two reasons. First, because I think that good things come to us by human creation after hard work, never by themselves. And second, because when we talk about acknowledging our dark side, we run the risk of being interpreted correctly or misinterpreted, as the case might be, as suggesting that this stuff is innate, that this competitive, aggressive, nasty nature in ours is something we were born with and we'll have to learn to acknowledge, as opposed to acknowledging the sense in which those nasty, evil parts of ourselves, the selfishness and the competition, are in large part social creations that, if anything, we overlook by simply talking about some individual or innate nature. So cooperative conflict and wrestling with ideas, I think, is fine. But there's a particular kind of conflict, as I've mentioned, that I think is especially disturbing, and that is competition. Basically, there are two respectable positions to take on competition in this country. One is unqualified endorsement, and the other is qualified endorsement. Unqualified endorsement is the Vince Lombardi quote, "Winning isn't everything, it's the only thing. It's a dog-eat-dog world out there." Or perhaps, given how early it starts now with preschool, we should say a doggy-eat-doggy world out there. And we've got to get kids primed for as much canine consumption as possible very early. If you can't stand the heat, etc., it's good for us, and so on. The second position, the second camp, suggests, I feel really silly trailing this tail around after me, but I don't think there's any real alternative. No, not that one. I guess that's a tale for another day, though, isn't it? The point I want to make is that the second position, the only other one, is one that says something like, competition has gone too far in this country. We push kids too fast and too hard to be number one. But if we keep things in perspective and don't get carried away, then competition can be natural and appropriate and healthy and so on. That used to be my position. But in writing No Contest, I went through more than 400 studies, and slowly I came to a third camp, which may be occupied only by me at this point. And that is as follows, that competition is not destructive or counterproductive in its excess. It is not destructive because we're doing it the wrong way. It is destructive by its very nature. The very phrase, healthy competition, it seems to me, and I think there are good, though largely unknown, data to support this, the phrase healthy competition is a contradiction in terms. And the ideal amount of competition, note I do not say conflict, the ideal amount of competition in any environment, the classroom, the workplace, the family, the playing field, is none. Now, I don't expect that most of you will agree with this. I didn't myself. But I want you to open to the possibility that all things that are bad in excess are not necessarily good in moderation. That's a surprising concept. I like to say to audiences who challenge me on this, you don't want to be so radical about it. We need some competition. I say, I agree with you. I think the same thing is true about torturing children. We don't want to overdo it, but you can't have none at all now, can you? The point is that not everything is good in a middle ground. We love this sort of reflexive position of let's not all overdo it, but we need some. Some things are inherently destructive. This position has not won me plaudits all over the country, as you can imagine. I'm alternately called a communist and a wimp as I discuss these things. Although never both. I guess you don't need to be spending $300 billion on the Pentagon if the communists... Well, you see what I mean. But it's one or the other. But the position is one that I think is backed by research, even though it sounds radical. The idea is that competition, no matter what amount it exists in, is always to that extent destructive. Some competitions are worse than others. Let me define my terms in good social science fashion here. I like to distinguish between what I call structural and intentional competition. By structural competition, I mean what I call mutually exclusive goal attainment, which is a fancy social science expression for I succeed only if you fail. There is a stronger version of this in which I succeed only if I make you fail. You see the difference? In the first case, maybe talking about golf or bowling, I do something, you do something, I do something, you do something. And at the end, of course, we're Americans, we have to have a winner, we compare scores. But we don't interfere with each other's performance. In the stronger version, I succeed only if I make you fail, here we find it in war or tennis. In which, in order for me to do well, I have to actively interfere with how you do it. So a good shot in tennis, for example, is one that you cannot return. That's true by definition. The goal, the objective of the activity is not merely to succeed at the end, but at each moment to interfere with your success. That doesn't mean all tennis players are nasty or neurotic or malicious. It means that the rules of the game, the structure, so to speak, require us to succeed at the expense of other people's failure. And that is what I am arguing is always and by its nature unnecessary and destructive. And I distinguish that structural competition from intentional competition, by which I mean simply the need for one person to be number one. Here we're talking not about the rules of the game, but about the personality. And why I think it's interesting to distinguish between the two is simply that we can have one without the other, and it helps us to clarify matters. Can we have intentional competition without structural? You bet. Some people may have come in here today with their objective being to be asked the cleverest question, or to be the best dressed, or something of that sort, be the funniest. Nobody else is trying for that. There are no trophies being given out. Everyone else just thought they were coming to a lecture. You know, they didn't realize it was a competition as it is for that individual. But even worse, you can have the reverse situation. I think it's worse. Structural competition without intentional. This is something we see every day in this culture. Individuals who are satisfied with simply doing their best, having fun, reaching excellence, but have to do that, have to engage in those goals in a way that prevents other people from reaching theirs. Success and victory, which are two completely different ideas, have been confused, confounded in this society, so we can't understand what it is to do one, to reach one without reaching the other. We have to tease these apart. I'm all in favor of success and excellence, as I am conflict in certain situations. The question is, do we have to do it to the exclusion of other people? I think the answer to that is clearly no. And in my book, I go through the four central myths of competition, which I will summarize very quickly now because I want to move on to the work that I'm doing since that book has come out. Let me deal with three consequences of competition and what has driven me to this surprising view that it's not merely bad in excess. First, there's the question of productivity, or excellence, success. This was the trickiest one. To be very honest with you, when I began this project, I already accepted that competition wasn't very good for us psychologically or for our relationships with each other. But I bought the party line that you needed some competition in order to push yourself to do your best. That there was some dialectical relationship between the two, and we couldn't dispense with that competition without there being a trade-off. Maybe it was worth it. Well, I was wrong. After going through hundreds of studies in the classroom and the workplace, I have become convinced of what I will put into one bald and startling proposition. Not only is competition not required for excellence, its absence is required for excellence. Now, most of these studies, all of these studies really, are available in any good library, but they don't get read and they certainly don't get talked about in the public arena or mentioned in popular publications for the most part. We are brought up not only to compete frantically, but to believe in competition. And it is awfully threatening to have people come along and say, you have been deluded. You are barking up the wrong tree. This is not what leads people to do their best. The Johnsons, David and his brother Roger, have done themselves scores of studies in the classroom. Others have been done by people like Bob Slavin at Johns Hopkins University and many others who have shown repeatedly that cooperation predicts to learning. I'm talking bottom line, hardcore success for children and adults whenever there's learning involved. Cooperation predicts to that more than does competition or individualized attainment. It's true in rural, urban, and suburban schools. It's true for all ages. It's true for all subject matters. The only place they found some variation is that the more complicated the task is, the worse competition does. The more cognitive problem solving and creativity is required, the worse competition stacks up when measured against cooperative approaches. This sort of thing has been found in the workplace too, both in terms of structural and intentional. There have been studies structurally suggesting that people in cooperative workplaces, real-world situations, not some contrived laboratory setup, do better when they're working together than when they're trying to best each other. As well, there have been studies from the University of Texas showing that personal need to compete, what I call intentional competition, gets in the way of success. I don't want to bore you with all these studies now. They're in my book, and others have come out since my book, but the point is that this counterintuitive for us Americans finding has been borne out again and again, even when researchers expected to find the reverse. And one after another, you see them saying, counter to hypothesis. Why? I think there are three reasons. The first, and I'm oversimplifying here because of the limited time available to me, and also because sometimes I get a kick out of oversimplifying. First, competition causes anxiety. When you are trying to beat someone and they're trying to beat you, you are distracted from doing the best job you possibly can because you're afraid someone else is going to step on your face. Not because they're mean, but because that's what competition by nature requires. Second, cooperation allows people to share their talents and their skills and their resources in a way that competition never does. This organization was founded by an astronaut. I've always asked, oh yeah, you think we would have gotten to the moon that fast if we weren't in a race against the Russians? Well, assuming that is a good goal, by the way, a question that is almost never asked when you're in a race, but assuming it is a good goal, I think we would have gotten there an awful lot faster had we been cooperating with the Russians. Because competition, among its other faults, is redundant, it's wasteful, it's duplicative. They're solving problems we've already solved, and vice versa. Only when you're able to share can you get there faster and more efficiently. You could share in a competition, but you'd be nuts. It's irrational. Why should I help you if your success comes at the expense of mine? You can't do it in a competitive situation. And that's the other reason why competition is so unproductive, so inefficient, because it doesn't allow for that. And the third reason is, in a way, the simplest and the most subtle at the same time. Not only is the idea of success or excellence completely different from victory or beating other people, not only are they conceptually different, but in actual life, they pull in opposite directions. The more I'm focused on getting that reward of being number one, the less I am concerned about what the task itself has to offer. You remember this kid in school? Ooh, 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 waving her hand wildly. Ooh, teacher finally calls on her. What was the question again? Why? Because she's not thinking about the subject matter. She's thinking about being number one. And those often are mutually exclusive in practice, the way they feel, in addition to the way the concepts are in themselves. Now, competition in this respect shares something destructive with all external or extrinsic rewards, whether it's not just the trophy, but grades or money. The more we think of ourselves as working for that goal, the less are we concerned about the intrinsic motivation, what's there in the task itself. Not only are external rewards such as competition less effective as motivators, but in fact they undermine intrinsic motivation. So that people who used to find something very interesting in its own right, once they start doing it in a competitive fashion or for money, you take away that money or the competition and they suddenly lost interest in it. There's a whole literature in the social psychology on this, and it is very powerful in contradicting the ways parents and teachers and managers have been leading their organizations or their homes. People have been systematically undermining curiosity, the single most important predictor to success, in the hope, in the process of trying to help it along. Let me tell you a quick little anecdote that illustrates that. There once was an old man who was taunted by the neighborhood school children. After they came out of school, they would walk onto his lawn and yell, "Hey, you stupid old bald-headed ugly," you know, and so on. And he got tired of this pretty fast. So he came up with a plan. He said, "If you kids come back tomorrow and yell those things at me, I'll pay each of you $1. Well, they thought that was pretty good. They hadn't expected it. So they came back even earlier the next day. And they yelled even louder about how ugly and stupid he was. And he came, and he said, "Thank you, here's your dollar, here's your dollar, here's your dollar, here's your dollar. If you come back tomorrow, kids, I can pay each of you $0.25. Well, they thought that was still pretty good. So they came back the next day and yelled even more loudly about how stupid and ugly he was. And he paid each of them $0.25. And he said, "Thank you, if you come back tomorrow, I can only pay each of you $0.01. They said, "A penny? Forget it." And they never came back again. You see the serious point here? He bought off their intrinsic motivation, and that's exactly what competition does. That's the whole idea. That's what he was trying to do, but it's not what teachers and managers are trying to do, and it's exactly what they're doing anyway. Those are the three reasons I think the research shows with surprising uniformity that competition does not predict a success. But competition is destructive in another respect, and this one I think is more requires less evidence, and that is that competition does not build character, whatever that means. If we mean by that something like self-esteem, the evidence is crystal clear here. I like to say that competition is to self-esteem as sugar is to teeth. That's what the evidence shows. In any competitive encounter, losing is always possible, and that feels lousy. But even when you win, you gloat for a while. You soar. You're impossible to live with. But you come down. In fact, you crash down, and you need more of it in order to get that same feeling. It's precisely like building up a tolerance to a drug. Or, if I can switch metaphors, it's like drinking salt water when you're thirsty. The solution is the problem. The emotional needs that we attempt to meet through competition are exacerbated by competition. They make us more dependent. They make our self-esteem more contingent. I am good so far as I beat these people in these activities. There is no winning there. It is not the way to solve those emotional problems. Winning doesn't do it, and losing doesn't do it. Competition only makes more of itself. And there's lots of evidence suggesting that cooperative people are not people lost in some amorphous pond, some blob of a group. In fact, people who are distinguished by their cooperativeness also tend to have more of an internal sense that they can control events. That may seem surprising. But the converse should not seem surprising. Competition does not promote strong, good individualism, in the best sense of that word. It promotes dependency, because competition requires other people. It requires that my self-evaluation is dependent on other people. I need you to beat, and I need you to watch me beat him. That has nothing to do with a strong sense of self, despite the prejudice of lumping together individualism and competition. The third thing that competition does is it poisons our relationships with other people. We are envious of winners, which is not a pleasant emotion. We are contemptuous of losers. If you think about it, there's no nastier epithet in the American lexicon than loser. And we're suspicious of just about everyone. Hostile toward them, because even if you're not my rival today, you could be tomorrow. So I'm going to hold you at a distance from myself. I'm going to hold a part of myself in reserve. Why should I trust you if you're my competitor? It's irrational. And all the empirical evidence suggests just what you would expect. People who compete, or people in competitive situations, communicate less effectively, are less trusting, are less sensitive to other people's needs, and less able to take their point of view, to do perspective taking. Kids who are cooperative or adults who are cooperative find that those skills are all increased in amazing ways. People sometimes ask, does competition cause aggression? Competition is aggression. The only question is whether it will occasionally manifest itself in outright violence. It is an againsting process. We are at loggerheads. We are working at cross purposes. And we do it in sports, and we do it in the classroom. Those spelling bees and competitive grading systems. Long after kids forget how to spell some long word, or forget who the 12th president of the United States was, or the binomial equations, what they remember is the fundamental lesson of any competitive classroom, which is other people are potential obstacles to my success. That's what we teach in competition. And no kind of competition, not even the parent who says, okay, who can get into their pajamas fastest? No competition, not even a nice game of underhand softball, which is more underhanded than we might suspect. No competition at work, friendliest employee, let alone for bonuses. None of this is innocuous. It all strengthens and reinforces and fortifies this message that sets us against one another. The question is not, do we need some competition? The question is, which kind is worse than the other? And that's why I'm suggesting that we have to work not merely to change our individual selves, not merely to go to psychotherapy and look deep within to find why I'm being competitive. I'll tell you why you're being competitive, because you live in a society that demands it of you every day of your lives. And until we make structural changes, it is self-deluding to talk about the prospect of merely working from within out. That's good too. I heartily recommend to you that you stop yourself and say, why did I interrupt him again? Why do I see this need to prove how clever I am? Why don't I just sit and listen and maybe learn something? That's great stuff. But it's not going to get very far until we change our recreation and our education and our workplaces and our families so that competition is no longer required. That's a harder task. And we Americans are very suspicious of any kind of structural change. We love to blame individuals. You're poor? You're just lazy. Get a job. You committed a crime? You're evil. Put you in jail for the rest of your lives. Kids aren't learning in school? Teachers aren't any good. You need more homework, etc. This lets us off the hook very easily, instead of looking at the deeper social and economic causes of these kinds of attitudes and these kind of behaviors. And that's what we have to change. And I'm afraid I have to take issue as well with my colleague Sam Keen in terms of changing the competition between the Soviet Union and the U.S. so we start competing about good stuff, like who can feed kids most. The answer to competition is not more competition. Any kind of competition, even in something that appears to be relatively salutary, something felicitous, something whose goal we all agree on, is going to fortify those underpinning structures that say we have to see who can be number one. The genuine alternative to being number one is not being number two. It's being able to dispense with these self-defeating rankings altogether. But a lot of people say, that's all nice to talk about, but what a charming thought. But competition is just part of human nature. It's usually with a shrug like this and a faintly patronizing smile, you know. What a charming thought. But unfortunately, it's just human nature to be competitive or aggressive or stubborn or territorial or lazy or selfish. Notice it's always the bad stuff. Nobody ever says, well, of course she helped him. It's just human nature to be generous. No, you don't say that. Which is why I've moved on from my work on competition and cooperation to my next book, The Brighter Side of Human Nature, which will be out in the spring, which deals with issues like altruism and empathy and the extent to which this too is a part just as real, just as natural of us. There's a lot of evidence there that's been collecting dust in the libraries. Let me talk briefly about competition, just an inevitable part of human nature. Well, the first question that occurs to me is, if it is, why are we spending so much bloody time training kids to be that way? Wouldn't that be redundant? What's the point? In fact, it's not redundant. I was giving a lecture once in a hotel, and I was riding the elevator down to the basement, and two boys, little boys in their swimming trunks, got on with their mother and some towels on their way to the pool, obviously, and she looked at them and said, so who's going to jump in the pool fastest? And they said, we both are. And I thought, How long can they hold out? Where does competition come from? We don't need innate theories. We have all the evidence we need in the way we subtly and not so subtly make sure that it's reproduced from generation to generation. You heard the evidence about nature. We can't appeal to nature in order to justify why competition exists. In fact, what happens typically, and the reason why, despite all of the evidence that has been around for quite a while that we just heard, the reason why we persist in this is not only watching those exciting nature documentaries on TV, which I watched, and I thought, well, nature is red in tooth and claw. Look at them going after each other. You know, it's more telegenic. I'm not suggesting those things on TV didn't really happen. It's not like they had highly paid stunt wolves or something. I mean, I'm sure it really happened. But it's not really what's good. What happens is that scientists live in this culture just like you and I do. We take our understanding about social interaction and project it onto nature, and then read it back from nature to justify our own social and cultural practices. Frederick Engels said that 100 years ago, and it's no less true today. So, you can't use nature. If you look at cross-cultural evidence, you find the same thing. There are some cultures without any competition, zilch, in recreation, in education, and in economics. Those cultures are sometimes called rather rudely primitive cultures, or, as I prefer to call them, non-VCR cultures. And this doesn't mean that we can or should be like them. What it does mean is that we need another explanation besides our dark side or something innate about us to explain this stuff. As Erich Fromm pointed out, you know, these are the primitive cultures. If anything, we'd expect them to be closer to nature. So if it were in human nature to be competitive and aggressive, they should be more so, not less so. And that's exactly right. That's exactly right. Even among Western industrialized countries, there is a range of competitiveness, and I think that's important to understand. Early childhood learning experiments show the same thing. Experimenters go in with kids, teach them how to cooperate in learning or in games. They come back, other experimenters come back, different task, weeks or months later, the kids have absorbed it. They like it. They retain it. All of this is very good evidence against the idea. By the way, an idea I have not been able to find a shred of evidence. I have been working on this topic for about 7 years, and I have not found a shred of evidence to support this common assertion that competition is just part of human nature. And I went looking for it in a lot of disciplines. Now, with aggression, we find a similar topic. I'll be very brief about this. The fact is that aggression isn't universal either. And even if it were, we cannot conclude from universality that it's in the genes. That's just a clever and facile and easy way to explain away things. Certainly there are some parts of the brain that, when stimulated, make people more aggressive or animals, but that doesn't mean that it is a matter of self-enclosed organisms with a self-contained reservoir of aggressive energy that has to be let out somehow. That notion, popularized by Freud and Conrad Lorenz, has been more decisively refuted than any other single old wives' tale I am aware of with respect to human behavior. It just is false. The idea of aggression being part of our nature and thus unavoidable makes about as much sense as saying that because oxygen blankets the earth and fires need oxygen, that it's in the nature of the planet for buildings to burn down. It makes no sense. It's a matter of environmental situations, even for animals, in ways that I won't get into now. And the idea that war is just part of human nature, which Donald Granberg may talk about later, who's done some very interesting research on beliefs about this, is even more absurd. Rousseau said, "War is not a relation between man and man, but between state and state. And individuals are enemies accidentally." That's why all that amazing propaganda stuff Sam Keane showed us is necessary. As he points out in his book, I think very trenchantly, in Faces of the Enemy, you need this propaganda because otherwise we won't be inclined to kill. There's no innate need for an enemy. There's a need to understand social and political and economic structures and why states get involved in this sort of process. But even if we move beyond aggression and beyond competition to look at human nature more generally, I think we should be very careful about the way we use that phrase. Cui bono? Whom does it benefit? I want you to, if you remember nothing else of what I say this afternoon, I hope you'll remember this, that human nature arguments are profoundly conservative arguments masquerading as realism. It is a way of silencing dissent. That is the way human nature arguments have historically been used, and not by accident. I like your idea for changing the way we do things, but unfortunately, the way we do things has been legislated by nature. It's just the way life is. Why do we think this? Well, for one thing, it's the easiest assumption available to us. If you look around and you see everybody around you, you know, in Chevy Chase, you know, or Alexandria living in a particular way, you say, well, it must be human nature to live this way. For another thing, the people turning out the studies have been trained in terms of genes and hormones and neurotransmitters. And as Abe Maslow used to say, if you give someone a hammer, they'll treat everything they come across as if it's a nail. That's exactly what goes on in the National Islam. And the media are partly responsible. And to the extent I write articles, you know, I have, for popular culture, I have tried to make a point of addressing this fact. The Seville statement, which is quoted in your pamphlet for this, the 1986 meeting of people from more than a dozen countries, experts in all social and natural sciences, came to a meeting in Seville in 1986 and concluded that aggression is not an innate, fixed part of human nature. Did you hear about that before this? Have you heard about the Seville statement? I sure as hell hadn't. That's because nobody in the media was interested in covering it. One of the organizers of that, David Adams at Wesleyan, told me that when he went to talk to reporters about the importance of this finding, one of the reporters said to him, call us back when you find a gene for war. That's the bias that we keep getting. Jeff Goldstein at Temple University says, if all you know about aggression is what you see on TV, what you know is 19th century biology. That's what we get. And that's what we get among the good science reporters, who seem to have their critical faculties paralyzed every time they see the word neurotransmitter. It explains everything. There are many other complex reasons I won't get into now. But not only do we assume there is a fixed human nature, we also assume there's a bad human nature. It's a two-step argument. The first is a kind of crass biological determinism that you get from Ann Landers all the way to the head of the American Psychiatric Association. And the other is the specific belief that this nature we have is fundamentally flawed. You'll recognize some of the contributors to that in various ideologies, ranging from orthodox psychoanalysis to Conrad Lorenz to the notion of original sin, for that matter. But we see it in other respects, too. One of the nicest points about this was raised in an article that appeared in Science in 1972, which I think is just terrific, by Leon Eisenberg. Eisenberg put it very well. He said, to believe that man's aggressiveness or territoriality is in the nature of the beast is to mistake some men for all men, contemporary society for all possible societies, and by a remarkable transformation to justify what is as what needs must be. Social repression becomes a response to rather than a cause of human violence. Pessimism about man serves to maintain the status quo. It is a luxury for the affluent, a sop to the guilt of the politically inactive, a comfort to those who continue to enjoy the amenities of privilege. He said it better than I can. This is not only a mistaken belief, but a politically loaded belief. The reasons for this, again, much too complex to go into in much depth. Number one, we're simply exposed to this stuff a lot. There was an interesting series of studies done by Harvey Hornstein in New York a while ago, in which he had subjects exposed to a radio news report, what they thought was a radio news report, about something really, really evil and dastardly that had just been done, robbing some old lady and mugging her and so on. And others happened to hear in another experiment about, or rather another condition of the same experiment, about those who heard an act of charity. And then what they had heard accidentally contributed to what they thought when asked about human nature. The people who had heard about the charitable action in the background noise behaved more cooperatively in a game, expected more cooperation from others, judged the defendant innocent more likely, recommended a more lenient sentence, and believed that people in general were more honest and helpful. I think something else is that it's cool to be cynical. You know, you really want to risk. You're right out there with your guts hanging out if you say, I think there's something good here, that empathy is, that helping is as natural as hurting. Dostoevsky said, one of his characters said, the higher the stage of development a man reaches, the more prone he becomes to cynicism, if only because of the increasing complexity of his makeup. I think a lot of us believe that. To be cool you know, in the sense of fashionable, is also to be cool in the sense of disdainfully skeptical. And then there is the false dichotomy. I think we set up a situation in which, on the one hand, are these smiley-faced Pollyannas where everything's lovely and human nature is terrific and anybody who acts badly just hasn't gotten in touch with his or her real nature and so on. A range from Carl Rogers to Mr. Rogers here. And then on the other hand, you've got the people, and they are in the majority in this culture, which is why I train most of my fire on them, is the people who say that we're basically bad by nature. We have to eliminate this false dichotomy. We have to understand that we're not denying the real evil that is done in our society and in other societies by affirming that there is more to us than just the competitiveness and the aggressiveness and the selfishness. In other words, it's time we debunk the debunkers. Well, these are very big questions, and I feel like by skipping over on so much territory, I have skipped over too much. But I will be around for the next couple of days and would invite those of you who don't get a chance to ask your question now to do so then. I think the overall message I'm trying to urge with respect to competition and the notion of human nature in general is that not only should we change, but we can. Thank you. How would you run a track meet? What instead? I'm not on a crusade for the abolition of track and field events. But if you ask me, is there a way for us to have fun in a way that does not involve us trying to triumph over other people? I think the answer is yes. If you ask people, do you enjoy playing tennis or squash or watching a track meet or the Olympics or something like that, people say yes, but my question is, when have you ever experienced a non-competitive recreational alternative? Most of us haven't. The first game I ever learned, I don't know about you, was at a birthday party. It was called Musical Chairs. X number of players scramble for X minus one chairs. A prototype of artificial scarcity. Stop the music each time. Out, 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 out. At the end, you've got one kid sitting down smug and triumphant, everybody else excluded from play. Losers. Unhappy. That's how you learn to have fun in America. No wonder we can't think of any better way to enjoy ourselves. We've never learned any other way. There are loads and loads of cooperative games, and I can point you, if you like, to where you can find them, as well as many ways in which we can challenge ourselves, feel that sweaty sense of accomplishment, that ecstatic feeling of transcendence, test our skills and limits, all without competition. You can try to do better today than you did yesterday or last week. I don't call that competition. Some people call it competing with yourself. I don't have any objection to that. Unless you get carried away with it to the point you never enjoy yourself. But in general, that's fine. But the need to try to struggle against another person is not necessary for a good time any more than it is to be productive or to learn. Aren't some situations inherently, unavoidably competitive, such as a shortage of jobs for professors, etc.? How can we structure things so that people in selective careers are not locked in a destructive, competitive, motivational structure? That's a very important question. Unfortunately, we're out of time. No. There is no easy answer to this. You know, the first thing to be said is that the arrangement we have that looks like a pyramid, specifically in corporations, and to some extent in terms of our universities too, I mean, God did not decree that organizations have to be shaped like pyramids. The idea that in order to do well, one must get up into a scarce position. The number of people available to do these tasks and the number of tasks are socially constructed decisions. I live in Boston where the parking is even worse than here. You know, there's one space, there's two cars, you look at it and you say, there's no choice but to compete. Well, yes, if you freeze the frame and only look at that. But you ask, you know, who decided the number of parking spaces? Who decided the quality of mass transit? Who made all of these decisions that led to that situation in which you have two people competing for the same job or two cars competing for the same space and so on? I don't have a recipe, and this goes for business and economic concerns either. I don't know how we can, in four easy lessons, transform our economic system into one that's cooperative and productive and democratic. I don't know the answer. I'm not satisfied with my own response any more than you probably are. But I know that we haven't even begun to ask those questions. The service I perform, if indeed it is a service, is the very modest one of saying, let's sweep out the myths that have been keeping us from asking those questions. And that goes for the structure in the universities as well. Aside from passive resistance a la Gandhi and King, what non-competitive strategies can we use to alter the behavior of those obsessed with political control, those who use violence to compete for power, as in China? Well, I'm not sure why we should sweep aside Gandhi and King, because I think they have more to tell us than the specific localized strategies that they did give us, which is to say we can learn a lot from them that may be appropriate. There's a fellow who teaches at Harvard and Southeastern Massachusetts University named Gene Sharp. I commend to you his works in telling us about useful, effective, powerful use of nonviolent resistance. This is a good example of why conflict should not be swept out. There was no one more concerned about conflict than Gandhi, except perhaps King. I mean, they were engaged in a kind of fight. They just refused to use violence there, a controlled, disciplined form of resistance. We can alter the behavior of other people by bringing it to their attention, but also by doing it from the ground up. That isn't to say I have an easy solution for what was going on for the tragedy in China, or for the at least equally, if not much greater, tragedy of soldiers killing students and children in various U.S.-supported regimes around the world as well, which is conveniently forgotten on the talk shows. But in all of those cases, I think we have to be very careful about saying, we can't just say, what do I do now? I need to grab a gun. But rather, how can we raise children so they don't grow up reproducing these same ineffective strategies? It is a tragedy that people say, you know, I agree with you that competition's destructive, but look, you got to fit in. You got to raise kids to adapt, to become competitive. You ask me why competition endures if it's not human nature, that's why. But not only are you doing your child a disservice, or your students, but you are also perpetuating the same kind of garbage in the next generation. Kids should be raised and taught to know what competition is, but there's a big difference between engaging in it uncritically and identifying it and knowing what it's about so you can choose not to do it. And that's the attitude we take about religion in the public schools. We can teach about religion without indoctrinating. The same thing is true here. I'll make a crazy suggestion. I think the evidence is so powerful and uniform on competition that we should teach kids explicitly about the dangers, just as we teach about the dangers of alcohol or drugs or driving recklessly. Don't only teach them cooperatively, teach them why you're teaching them cooperatively. Let's see. Does your tirade... I am passionate about this. I make no excuse for that. I don't know if you're applauding the questioner or me, but who cares? I mean, I'm passionate about this, and I hope you don't misinterpret, the idea of this passion for either lack of empirical support, which is in the book, and I didn't want to bore you with it, or with the sense that, you know, I'm trying to compete myself. Some people have accused me of that, not perhaps understanding the difference between thinking, you know, in a passionate way and trying to wave the banners for this sort of thing to get people to change the way they look at these questions on the one hand, and wanting to defeat other people rather than opening up a dialogue on it, which I hope is what I want to do on the other. Does your tirade suggest that socialist cultures are more conducive to fulfillment than capitalist cultures? It depends what socialist cultures you mean. I gave lectures in Sweden last year and looked around for a while. And yes, I would say that that is a culture, if you define it as socialist, as being far more conducive to human fulfillment than this one. If you were talking about the Soviet Union, I don't regard them as socialist. I don't think any right-thinking person who's read Marx would. I think it's a conspiracy between the leaders of the U.S. and the leaders of the Soviet Union to call them socialist, each for their own purposes. I have no sympathy for that. I'm delighted to the extent they're moving toward more democratization. But if we're talking about a totalitarian, gray, unproductive structure, I don't want that. But, you know, if you can only see in black and white, it's time to buy a new TV, you know? There are other possibilities here. Scott Peck in The Road Less Traveled claims there is no altruism. He pulls in 700 people per lecture. Please comment. Hey, Donald Trump pulls in 50,000 times more dollars than I do. What am I supposed to say about that? He claims that there is no, because, I haven't read Scott Peck, I'll be honest with you, but if he's claiming that there is no such thing as altruism, that seems to me it might implicitly suggest that it is an apology. It allows you to live your life in in relative ease without worrying about what else is going on. I don't know that Scott Peck claims this, but anyone who claims that is making a very sexy, saleable message that allows one to stroke him or herself with saying, yeah, I'm doing okay. There's no reason why I have to help. And let me, on the subject of altruism, also note that very destructive is the way we limit, circumscribe artificially the way we understand that word, too, to bring me back full circle to what I was saying about conflict and so on, cooperation. When we hear altruism, Teresa, that's a problem. It, altruism only means, at least the way I look at it, that I helped you only to help you. That goes on every day. And to the extent we cordon it off to the saints, we allow ourselves to recline into a life of self-aggrandizement with a clean conscience. I don't have to be altruistic. I can't be like Mother Teresa with the lepers. Therefore, I can do whatever the hell I want. How can we address the impact of sex role stereotyping, which particularly expects males to be competitive? I have a whole chapter on this in my book, and I have to say that one of the things that troubles me more deeply than anything else is the idea that women have been urged in the last couple of decades to be as obnoxiously competitive as men under the banner of liberation. I feel that I have, as a man, an awful lot to learn from some values traditionally associated with women of relationship and cooperation and so on. And it pains me very deeply that it's being turned around, that instead of men becoming the students, they're becoming the teachers. It serves no one's interest and is not, in my view, a productive response to sexism, which is very real, to become as the people whom we are trapped by. You know, in a sentence, everything that men do is not worth imitating just because men are doing it. you know what I mean? I mean, in the early part of this century, women said, how come only men get to smoke? It's not fair. And they're right. It isn't fair. Every single opportunity open to men should be open to women. But we can't leave it at that. The question is, you know, do I want to go in? Where is in? Anyone on the outside wants that, you know? And it's very difficult for me. You know, it's a hard issue. Because I am not by any means urging any kind of reactionary back to the, women get back to the kitchens where you belong. I'm suggesting that we all need to have those opportunities open to us, but we don't need more competition. We need less of it by men as well as women. Now today, to continue with that brief metaphor, women have lung cancer rates that are equal to that of men. Congratulations. You know, that's not liberation. That's not a response to sexism. That's buying into the structure. Now, we address the sex role stereotyping by making sure that these norms of cooperation become the norms to which everyone aspires, men as well as women. These are very deep, but there is zero evidence that any of this stuff is inborn or in the genes. I have gone through the literature on sex roles with respect to aggression, nurturing, and competition pretty carefully, and all of the claims are really unsubstantiated to the effect that we can shrug it off as being a function of testosterone. In one sentence, I will tell you that a lot of studies say that testosterone levels and other hormonal levels are not merely causes of behavior, but the effects of behavior. When you change various organisms like some apes and chimps and move them into different dominance hierarchies, the testosterone level changes. Biology is not merely the cause, it is also the reflection, but that unfortunately challenges our simplistic idea of determinism. Last one. Okay. I'm giving in to the same temptation to make it a good one. All right, I see the irony. Will you speak a bit about the role of challenge vis-a-vis competition and or cooperation? Sure. I'm a big believer in challenge. The only question I ask, and I'll say this again, is whether challenge has to exist at some other people's expense. Does it have to be a zero-sum game? It is competitive thinking that is responsible not only for a lot of obnoxious people that we both know, but for the potentially most deadly form of competition altogether, which is the arms race that threatens to extinguish all of us. The assumption that when the Soviets offer us an arms control initiative, it's good for them and therefore bad for us, is exactly the sort of thinking that will annihilate us. And merely moving that competition to other arenas doesn't change the thinking. We have to do that in other ways. And the way we have to do it in particular is thinking of challenges that we can meet, number one, at least without competition, And sometimes that means working independently. But number two, more significantly, with others. Because challenges often apply, as Robin Dawes, I think, is about to tell you, and behavior is often construed and challenges available to us understood in terms of us. Not us versus them, but us. Cooperation does not require simply working together in one group in order to triumph against other groups. That's all we know in this country. Basketball games, international rivalries, companies. That is a distorted, a truncated version of cooperation. Does not require intergroup competition. We can understand challenge without ever appealing to notions of besting other people. And we can also do it even better by working with other people to accomplish mutual goals. Thanks.
Now, I certainly appreciate his emphasis on altruism, something that I've been researching for the last 10 years or so, and something that, in my experience, the more people deal with money, the harder they find to grasp, because it's antithetical to the way money works. To bridge the gap between our two segments, I just introduce the thought that just as Alfie Cohn presents the need for competition as some kind of delusion in the Q&A section, we can tell this is a man who's aware that a lot of the givens of our social and economic systems are resting on such unquestioned faith, the hierarchical element, the competitive nature of modern enterprises and money itself, the epitome of the zero-sum game. As he says, what would it be like to work with other people towards common goals? Well, the world as a whole has common goals as never before, in terms of, say, preventing any more nuclear waste from being emitted into the atmosphere, stabilizing the climate, a lot of ecological aspects. Is it true that increased food in Africa, increased welfare for them, means decreased welfare for us? I see it as rather the converse. The better everybody is in the world, or the better anybody is, the better I am, in part, because the separation that the economic model confirms and is promulgated by all sorts of systems seems to me to be an illusion. As Charles Eisenstein would say, we have passed the point of maximum separation and we are now returning to understanding our true meanings, our personal destinies, the love of life that is within us, that cannot be controlled by extrinsic pressures, that does not form itself into a hierarchy. But what would life be like beyond money? Not an easy thought for many of us. Of course, some people have already made the jump and live that way. Now, to understand the gravity, to understand the depth of the conditioning, going back a few thousand years, we're going to pick up where we left off. This is the conclusion of Chapter 9 of David Graeber's Debt, the first 5,000 years. I will add one final note here. In Greece, as in Rome, attempts to solve the debt crisis through military expansion were always, ultimately, just ways of fending off the problem, and they only worked for a limited period of time. When expansion stopped, everything returned to as it had been before. Actually, it's not clear that all forms of debt bondage were ever entirely eliminated, even in cities like Athens and Rome. In cities that were not successful military powers, without any source of income to set up welfare policies, debt crises continued to flare up every century or so, and they often became far more acute than they ever had been in the Middle East, because there was no mechanism, short of outright revolution, to declare a Mesopotamian-style clean slate. Large populations, even in the Greek world, did in fact sink to the rank of serfs and clients. Athenians, as we've seen, seem to assume that a gentleman normally lived a step or two ahead of his creditors. Roman politicians were little different. Of course, much of the debt was money that members of the senatorial class owed to each other. In a way, it's just the usual communism of the rich, extending credit to one another on easy terms that they would never think to offer others. Still, under the late Republic,